The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis, and this is Music Weekly. This week,
he was profound when he spoke to you in a way that no one I've ever spoken to was. I used to get a feeling from him. He would come out with things that came from somewhere so deep. I used to get a feeling like it might have been to talk to any of the great Greek philosophers, you know, who also like to get off their heads, of course, right?
The men involved in publishing a posthumous memoir of Gil Scott-Heron tell us how the book came together. And there's new tracks from the Magnetic Fields, Shauna and Jack Frost, as well as Song for Wendy. All to come in this week's Music Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, welcome, and a belated Happy New Year. It might be a bit late for that. It's still nice to wish people a Happy New Year. It is our first programme back. Happy New Year to my guests. Rob Fitzpatrick, hello.
Hello, Happy New Year to you too.
And Alex McPherson, hello.
Hi, Happy New Year to you.
Did you both have a nice Christmas and New Year period?
Alex, you go first.
I survived it. New Year's was fun.
What did you do on New Year? Tell me about New Year.
I went to a house party and then we ended up in an estate, a disused estate somewhere in South London.
Were you with Dan Hancock's?
I was.
Because I saw him tweeting pictures of this disused estate. It looked amazing. It was like some old reggae sound system or something.
I don't quite remember that bit.
Hey!
In Camberwell?
I think it was Camberwell. My memory is quite hazy.
This sounds like an amazing night that you had.
It was actually, because if it's the one in Camberwell, that was a very famous, it was a kind of a Rasta encampment for quite a few years.
The Haygate estate.
Oh, no, well, the Haygate estate's a different one, I think.
Yeah, I think this one's been...
In Elephant and Castle?
Yes.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, that was not a Rasta encampment.
Yeah.
So your knowledge of the disused estates of London, does the amazing credit.
I am literally writing a book about them. I wish I was. That's a pitch.
Oh, right.
Anybody wants a book about this?
Someone should. Someone absolutely should.
It's a great idea. Rob, what did you do on New Year?
Well, I didn't go to any disused estates.
No.
I went to a friend's house and had an agreeable dinner and then went home and then got up in the morning with the kids.
Amazing. Hurrah.
Excellent. Much like any other night, really.
Yeah. Absolutely, absolutely. Well, look, we're going to start the week talking about this man.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
You see that black boy over there running scared? His old man in a bottle. He done quit his 9-to-5. He drank full time and now he's living in a bottle. I'm demanding him now.
That's Gil Scott-Heron, who died last year, age 62. This month sees the publication of his book, The Last Holiday, which is both a history of his involvement in Stevie Wonder's campaign to get Martin Luther King's birthday recognised as an American national holiday, and a more wide-ranging memoir. I talked to publisher and friend Jamie Bing and XL Recordings' Richard Russell, who produced his remarkable final album on New Here, about The Last Holiday and the man behind the myth.
Oh, uno, dos. Uno, dos, tres, cuatro.
I suppose the first question, the most obvious question to ask you, is how you both came to know Gil Scott-Heron. Starting with you, Jamie.
I first came across his work as a student at Edinburgh University in the late 80s. And then, as luck would have it, 8 months later, he was playing the Queen's Hall in Edinburgh, and I went and saw him live. Kind of the relationship developed organically over a period of years, but I first met him when I kind of got backstage at the Queen's Hall and got him to sign a bootleg. He was amused by the fact that I was bringing this record he'd never seen in his life to him, and that was a nice way to break the ice. And we then became we saw a lot of each other over the years, and he was a very dear friend.
Richard, how about you? How did you sort of become involved with him?
Well, I was familiar with him through the, you know, what used to be called the Rare Groove scene in London, which was a sort of bolt onto to hip-hop, really, which I was obsessed with when I was a teenager. And then in terms of actually meeting him, that was because the thought had occurred to me to make a record with him. I wanted to make a record with him. So I got in touch with Jamie, and Jamie collected me with Gil, and I went out to New York to see him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was quite... You were, you know, friends for the last sort of 20 years of his life, which is, you know... I mean, his life was always fairly rumbustuous, but this was a particularly... You know, he's in and out of prison a lot. He's clearly got, you know, a serious drug problem. Was he an easy man to work with?
In certain respects, the easiest. And
really?
In other respects, enormously frustrating. But he was extremely... He was such a joy to spend time with that it made... The frustration sometimes when things didn't happen quite on the time scale that we were planning them to happen. Who gives a shit at the end of the day, you know? I felt enormously fortunate just to get close to him because he taught me a hell of a lot and we laughed so much. He was a doctor helping young girls along. If they wasn't too far gone to have problems. Not easy. You know, when someone's inside, it's pretty hard to try and progress a book that you've been working on together. And, you know, I was talking to Richard as we were driving over here that, you know, it was almost 15 years ago that I first was given by Gil some of the chapters of The Last Holiday. Mm-hmm. So this has had a long gestation period as a project. And, of course, on one level, that's frustrating. But you know what? I've always subscribed to that view that ripeness is all, you know. Mm. It's like... Things happen when they're meant to happen. I'm really sad Gil's not around for the publication of this book, but in a funny sort of way, maybe he needed not to be around for this book to be published, which is a sound might sound perverse.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, the end of his life suddenly created an impetus to kind of... This thing had been in a kind of free-form limbo state for many years, this project, and getting Gil to do things in any structured way was not always... easy, but he had been writing this thing progressively, and I don't know if you're aware, but the book originally, the pages he gave me were, it was written as a third-person narrative, which is quite unusual for a memoir. He referred to himself as the artist throughout, and it's part of what Gil was trying... This book is not about Gil. He didn't want it to be about him. He wanted it to be about two heroes of his, Martin Luther King and Stevie Wonder, and he wanted to tell the story of how Martin Luther King's birthday came to be a national holiday in 86. And the thing that has never been truly credited in Gil's view is was Stevie Wonder's incredible role in making that happen. This 41 city hotter than July tour that he was by chance in a way lucky enough to end up going on because of Bob Marley dying. That's the reason he ended up doing this tour, and he wanted to tell this story. So it's called The Last Holiday because it's about this tour and it's about this national holiday, the last holiday that America will ever make because it can't afford to give anymore, was his line. And so he called it The Artist because he didn't want it to be about Gil.
He wanted to take a step back.
So, but I persuaded him because the more he wrote and the more we read together that actually that conceit didn't work over a sustained period. It worked brilliantly in chapters, but actually it was better to do it and it'd be slightly less tricksy and just tell it as a first-person narrative. I last spoke to him about 2 months before he died, and it was funny, we were talking about the book and how we should make it finally happen and actually kind of commit it to the printer, as it were, and we'd kind of come up with the plan out by which that was going to be done. So it felt like it was coming to this point, and he had spent a lot of time working on the structure of it. So, but it, you know, he didn't have to die for it to come out. Maybe that's the wrong way to express it, but it just as it happened, his death coincided with the timescale on which this project came to its fruition, and I think it's pretty close as is to what it would have been had he still been around. Say the words of the word. Tell me, brother, have you heard? I'm from Johannesburg. Tell me what's the word now. A sister woman, have you heard?
Richard, you sort of took Gil Scott-Heron on at a time when he was basically been written off as a recording artist. I mean, he hadn't made a studio album for decades, really.
17 years. Yeah.
So how did you find working with him? I mean, A, it's a monumental task to take on because, you know, you've got someone that is widely thought of as unreliable, is a drug addict, is this, that and the other. You just sort of steam in there and make an album. How was the experience of making that final record?
Well, none of us are perfect, are we?
Absolutely.
I think there's something in what Jamie said about, in some ways, was the easiest person you've ever worked with because he was completely committed to the truth. He never lied about anything. Mm. He was completely direct about things. And when I approached him with the idea to make a record, I kind of felt like he looked in my eyes and possibly kind of looked into my soul and said, yeah, Gil didn't want to promote very much, and that was just fine with me.
Right.
And actually, when I said, I think you should do this, and this is the reason I'm here today, is he said, I don't want to do that. I don't want to go and talk about me. You and Jamie go and talk about me, which is something we've never done until now.
Right.
So that's why I thought this would be a good thing to
do. Why do you think he wanted that? Why do you think he preferred you two to talk on his behalf?
Because I think it was boring for him to do it. I don't think he wasn't interested in, like, analysing himself.
Whatever was going on in his personal life, whatever was he was doing, and, you know, I watched and was part of things that he was doing at certain stages, he was always so lucid, and he was always so gentle and warm, and as Richard said, honest. It was just like no bullshit in there. And I suppose the interviewing process, he thinks, is just...
And it was honest. beyond lucid, wasn't it? It was profound. Mm. He was profound when he spoke to you in a way that no one I've ever spoken to was. I used to get a feeling from him. He would come out with things that were so... came from somewhere so deep. I used to get a feeling like it might have been to talk to any of the great Greek philosophers, you know, who also like to get off their heads, of course, right? You know, that he was genuinely...
Deep. One of the things he says in the book, which I kind of just, to me, so captured him, is this lovely line where he says, you know, I was trying to get people who listened to me to realise that they were not alone.
That was his thing. People think he kind of dropped out because there weren't records. He just wasn't into making records.
Yeah.
But he never stopped performing. He was performing all the way through, consistently through that period. And, you know, making records is laborious compared to performing, compared to that visceral. And I sort of realised after a while, my sort of idea and world of making records is quite a laborious process. It involves computers and stuff, which isn't really where he was coming from.
Yeah.
So I sort of worked that out. It's like he wanted to come, get inspired, and go. He made some brilliant jokes in the studio when he used to see us noodling away on computers, because he was like, wow, you need a degree in computer science to make music these days. But I enjoy the sort of lengthy, laborious aspects of record making. I like them.
Mm.
But that's because in some fundamental ways, I'm not as interesting as someone like Gil. He was grooving, and that was when he could have sworn the room was moving. But that was only in his mind, he was sailing. He never really seemed to notice vision failing.
You know, talk about coming the full circle, and the other side is one of my favourite tracks of his, where he talks about circles a lot. If you go back to Small Talk at 125th and Lenox, there's actually a really beautiful relationship between I'm New Here and Small Talk at 125th and Lenox, the Spartanness of it. And
first time anyone's ever identified that. That's exactly right. That is exactly right. That's the total full circle thing. And those two records, I think, are a pair.
Yeah. I think it's the most personal thing he ever made as an album, I'm New Here. It feels the one that bears his kind of... Where Did the Night Go? I think is one of the most intense... To me, it's as intense as The Other Side, which is another one to me, which is a real bearing of his soul in a way that, you know, he often bared other people's souls. Like, Home Is Where the Hatred Is is an incredible bearing of a young man's soul and not his. And I'm sure you know this anecdote, which is worth telling if you don't know, that Esther Phillips, when she covered Home Is Where the Hatred Is. Like, she met Gil after she'd recorded, and she's like looking him in the eyes, and she's like, God damn, I always had you down as a junkie, man. And he said, you know, there was never any I in the heron, which was how Gil then told, which I always thought was a very nice way, and again, his wordplay, there was never any I in the heron. But Esther Phillips was convinced he must have done junk to have written a song where you felt such a kind of empathy with a young junkie. But anyway, he got into other he as I said, he bared other people's sick souls.
How would you define what Gil Scott-Heron's legacy is after his death? Because people always say hip-hop, and he was very equivocal about hip-hop. I mean, he wasn't, you know...
Well, I love what he said about it. You know what he said about that? It's one of my favourite one-liners of his. When asked about, you know, did you invent hip-hop, he said, that's one thing they can't blame me for.
He hated labels. And he hated any gun. This is why, I'm sure you've heard this anecdote too, when he first plays Glasgow, where obviously there was this whole history because his dad, Gil Heron, had played for Celtic. And when he goes on stage, he's like wearing a Rangers hat and a Celtic scarf, and he hated, and it was true with the Panthers as well and stuff. He was like, he didn't like being put into any camp because he said, as soon as you do that, you're immediately alienating yourself from others. And I never wanted to do that. He was always wanting to get into universal conversations, kind of everyone's conditions. You know, he wasn't interested in championing particular causes. Now, he, because of his experiences, was able to articulate the Black American experience like very few people have been able to do, and you can see why Chuck D, who,
of course,
when we did Chuck D's book Fight the Power, I remember talking to Chuck as we were driving in London to a thing and talking to him about Gil, and him just saying with such honesty that there is no one as important in his creative life as Gil Scott-Heron. He was the one who taught him really more than anyone about how to see the world and how to be informed and how to try and break down stereotypes whilst kind of recognising stereotypes. And he's full of paradoxes, Gil, as well. And I don't know if that's a legacy, but it's certainly something he embraced happily, was the paradox. And that's one thing that people can't get their heads around, is how can someone who wrote songs like The Bottle and Angel Dust and Home Is Where the Hatred Is, you know, then seemingly have this kind of chronic drug problem. And, you know, Gil's view is, I didn't really have a drug problem while I was taking the drugs. I was, like, very happy taking the drugs. And I tell you what, it didn't stop him doing a hell of a lot of amazing performances. Now, there's part of me that's sad. I think he might have done even more, perhaps, if he hadn't spent as many hours of his life smoking what he did. But, you know, you just have to, again, look at it in the round and think, well, each person in their life has to choose to live it as they see fit.
Richard Russell and Jamie Bing there, and the book, The Last Holiday, a memoir by Gil Scott-Heron, has just come out. Okay, time to listen to some new music. Three tracks. We're going to start with Rob's choice.
You loved me for a little, you could not love me long. I'll lend my spirit a song. You loved me for an hour. In a world of laughter, in a rush of dance, lost in the moment.
That is a song for Wendy. And yes. Jenny Kiss Me. Rob, you brought that in. Tell us about Song for Wendy.
Song
Tell
for
about
Wendy. Okay, so quite an interesting story, actually, this one. Alexis, thank you for asking.
Hey.
Song for Wendy. They are an Icelandic stroke, if you like, slash Danish duo, also a couple, love fans. It's Disa Jacobs, that's the lady.
Right.
And Mads Moritz.
Wow, great name.
Great name. Mads Moritz, who's the chap. And they are Song for Wendy. The Wendy in Song for Wendy is, I think, is Wendy Cope, who's the British poet.
Is it really? Is
yes,
it
and I'll tell Wendy you why. Cope? I'll tell you why. Because there's a kind of a plan for Song for Wendy, and their plan is they take English poetry from the last 300 years and set it to music, their own music. So that one there, Jenny Kissed Me, was written by Leigh Hunt in 1838.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And interest, here's a bit of hot off the press gossip for you. The Jenny was mentioned was the Jenny was the wife of Victorian author and moral desperado Thomas Carlyle.
Wow.
True story.
You heard it here first,
yeah,
kids.
You heard it here
the bleeding edge of, rock music is David Scuster.
This is a track from the album. There's another track on it, which is called, they call, I Think of Little Else, which is actually a Wendy Cope poem.
Wow.
Under a different title.
But it's a concept album.
It's a concept album. Yeah, and they sort of that one there sort of got a bit of a kind of Jackson C. Frank. It's a bit like You Never Wanted Me, that kind of thing. It's that sort of quite English sort of folk thing. But there's other ones which are more they do a lot of kind of ambient-y kind of keyboard things with poetry and things like that. Makes it sound horrible, actually.
You're making it sound like the worst record.
Yeah, I know. As soon as I said that, I thought that sounds like the worst thing ever. But it's actually very, very good. It's a very, very good record. And it's on a little Icelandic label called Senna. But it's going to come out later in the year on a British label called Names. Mm.
What's interesting is that all this story, but the historical figures that they use and the poetry that they use, I would never have got that from the actual record.
No.
And it's actually quite rare that you find acts who are willing to sort of do that sort of high concept stuff, but not sort of thrust it in your face in the music.
Yeah, yeah. So it's quite hands-on. Actually, you wouldn't know, would you?
No.
You wouldn't sort of think this is a track from a concept album about poetry, which is undoubtedly a good thing, I think.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I got the album a few days ago and I listened to it 4 or 5 times without even realising that, and then suddenly all those things fell into place.
That's really good for me. It's also good for English teachers.
Yeah, oh, that,
when I was at school, we were subjected to, I believe it's Steely Span, doing Twa Corbies.
Oh, not all around my hat.
No, obviously not. And you could see...
In
English class, yeah. And then somebody, one of the sort of metal kids, brought in The Rime of the Ancient Mariner by Iron Maiden.
Of course.
So, I mean, between those two polarities,
you
know, there's not much for an English teacher. I don't know how I got onto this topic.
I suppose it's just but a lot of the poetry they use. I mean, there's another one. It's not all English poetry. I mean, there's one by Phyllis McGinley, which is called I Wish I Didn't Talk So Much at Parties. But they're, you know, it's 300 years worth of famous and less famous, lot less famous poetry getting used, but like I say, you wouldn't listen to it and go, "Oh, brilliant poetry and acoustic guitars! How amazing!"
Is the whole album in that vein? I mean,
no, I'd say probably about half of it is in that vein. Half of it is a bit more electronic. Some of it's a cappella. So there's all sorts of there's fun for all the family on there.
Alex, did you enjoy it?
I did. I liked the atmospheres. I didn't quite get with the singing. I was trying to work out whether it was the boy or the girl singing, and I couldn't work it out.
Wow. That's the beauty.
They like that a lot these days, aren't
they? Yeah, you can't tell them apart.
I feel like my dad, I can't even tell whether they're boy or girl.
Yeah. Is this on the right speed? Yeah. I liked it too. There's a lot of that kind of quiet. Scandinavia does sort of sugar coated acoustic.
Scandinavia
stuff.
Is the home of that kind of.
It really is, isn't it?
Not always sugar coated. Sometimes it can be quite dark and sinister. One of my favourite records from last year was the Phaedra album. Right. She's a Norwegian folk singer.
Oh, right.
And it's just full of titles like "Death Will Come" and stuff like that. It's very,
that's
very cheerful.
Norway is the sort of dark nation. It's where all them dark crime thrillers come from. They were burning churches, all the dark, the black metal,
long winter,
deep within the psyche.
Yeah.
The more sugar coated stuff. I was once informed by Benny and Bjorn from ABBA. Actually.
Hello.
The reason that their melodies were so...
Yeah.
Apparently, Swedish folk music is very, very kind of sweet in tone and is very kind of melodically rounded in a way that maybe Norwegian folk... Or certainly British folk, isn't it? British folk. And that's maybe where some of the Scandinavian things
come from. It's the sweet and the sour.
That's why I've never got with Swedish folk, really, because it's too twee for me.
Yeah,
but that actually, if I hadn't known they were Icelandic, I'd have thought they were British.
Well, yeah.
Anyway, that album, Song 4, what's the album called?
The album is called
Meeting Point.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's out now on import.
No, you can get it on import. It's coming out on a label called Names. They've got a few tracks up on SoundCloud as well. So you can hear it there at the moment.
Marvellous. Marvellous. Well, the next track is from me.
I don't know why I even went. It's really not my bag. Just thought it might be funny to see Andrew.
That's The Magnetic Fields, Andrew in Drag, which is out and about on the internet now. It's from a forthcoming album called Love at the Bottom of the Sea. I am an unashamed fan of The Magnetic Fields. I feel that, you know, they made, as I doubtless know if you're aware of that work, they made an album in 1999 called 69 Love Songs, triple CD, three and a bit hours long. And I think ever since then they've struggled a little bit in The Magnetic Fields. That was such a kind of monumental, big thing that, you know, they've struggled with making albums that just have a concept behind them or whatever. However, he continues to write the occasional great song. That really made me laugh. The new album, it's not amazing, the new album. There's has the best set of song titles. Of any album that I've seen. They're just absolutely hilarious. I've Run Away to Join the Fairies. I'd Go Anywhere with Hugh. All She Cares About is Mariachi. And one brilliantly called I Don't Like Your Tone. Which is just a fantastic name for a song. I like what they do. I like their sound. They're not doing anything different.
No.
Though he might reasonably argue that if you wanted to hear him do something different, he did make that album of, was it Chinese opera?
Right.
It was all in Cantonese or whatever, and
it's something that you don't want to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, you know what? I'm kind of all right for it.
Yeah, you know, it's like you stick with doing what you know.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw it open to the floor, Alex. You were saying you're not a Magnetic Fields fan.
No, it's funny that he has a song called "I Don't Like Your Tone" because I don't like the tone of his voice at all.
It's difficult to get with.
This is actually the first full Magnetic Fields song I've heard because I heard half a song about 10 years ago, and it was so off-putting that I've just avoided him for a decade. Reading a sequence of interviews where fans go to interview him and end up thinking, I really hate this guy, didn't exactly endear me to him either. I didn't like that. I just think, why are you singing like that? Why is it so mopey? Why are the lyrics so bad? I really hate this.
You think the lyrics are bad? I think he's probably the best extant lyricist in the world. So
really?
I think he's literally, I think at his best, you know.
Nailing colours to the mast here.
Nailing colours to the mast. On his best, he's literally on a sort of level with Cole Porter or somebody like that. I think he's like the best songs on 69 Love Songs deserve to be in the sort of great American standards.
The canon.
And the canon. Yeah. I'm amazed more people don't do covers of them. Also because his voice is so difficult to get on with. I always think, you know, it would be good to slip. If I was doing a, Rod Stewart sings the Great American Songbook thing. If I was a producer, I would say, why not do Busby Berkeley Dreams? Why not do something?
Over clever.
Really? Interesting.
He's taken this concept of how he, you know, the only girls ever fancied is this guy who was in drag, but it doesn't go anywhere with it and doesn't pull me into it emotionally. There's no narrative there. It's like he's thought of this clever concept and it's just sitting there with it.
Interesting. Rob?
I have to say, I sort of agree with quite a lot of what Alex said there. I'm not a fan of this band by any stretch of the imagination. There's something that I find a bit like he's put up a wall between me and him, that a wall of kind of irony or something.
Definitely,
that I have that I'm expected to climb over to go, oh, brilliant, it's brilliant on the other side when you're over, but I can't be bothered to climb over it.
That's interesting.
I don't care enough about it to climb over it. But on the other hand, I do think that he's written some amazing songs. But and I wonder whether what you say about people not covering, I wonder whether he's controlling who can, you know.
Yeah,
it's something that no, I don't want you to. There's something kind of off-putting about someone who appears to have an element to them where they're pushing you away and they're doing this stuff like, oh, get lost, I don't want you to. And it's like, well, okay, then there's like a million other places I can go.
No, the last time I saw them live, I've seen them live a number of times, I saw them do 69 Love Songs in its entirety, and that was brilliant. That was like 2 nights at the Bush Theatre.
Yeah.
Then the last time I saw them, I've never seen a sort of display of misanthropy on a stage quite like the one that Stephen Merritt put up. He'd clearly had a row with Claudia Gonson, who's his main collaborator, before they went on stage.
Yeah,
there was a terrible atmosphere between the two of them. Plus, he was claiming to have some sort of ear infection that meant he didn't like loud sounds. So every time the audience applauded, he literally stuck his fingers in his ears. and it was an unbelievably disheartening evening, you know. I take your point.
Yeah.
About there being, and this is definitely a this album. In fact, all the songs seem to be a bit like this. There are, you know, quite arch.
Yeah.
The song called "The Horrible Party" is very funny, but at his best, I would say on 69 Love Songs, on songs like Busby Berkeley Dreams. I think of the other ones that I really love, acoustic guitar. I mean, numerous songs. I don't think there's any concept. I think these are kind of really honest, incredibly moving love songs.
Alex, I thought the lyrics were really good, and I thought, perhaps there's that sort of thing where you get. It's a bit like people used to say in a magazine to work back from the cover line, you know. And he's written the cover line, then he's written the feature, and then he's going to put some some music to it, and it's a bit kind of reverse engineered.
Well, I think that's a very insightful thing generally about what's been wrong with the magnetic field since 69 Love Songs, in that every album has come. First there was I, and every song began with the letter I.
Yeah, yeah.
Then there was Distortion, which was kind of a homage to the first Jesus and Mary Chain album.
Yeah.
And then I can't remember what the last one's concept, but there was part of me that was just write some bloody songs, mate. Just write some songs.
But the other thing is you know, I was talking to someone recently who was saying one of the problems with bands when they've created a decent-sized body of work, is that when people think about them and play them and review them, sitting thinking about the sort of thing that we do, you're not really reviewing them, you're reviewing the ones that you liked 10 years ago.
I have to say, if you like the Magnetic Fields, you will like the new album. If you don't like the Magnetic Fields, it ain't going to convert anybody.
No.
Anyway, our last track is Alex's Choice. To turn out the potty, probably to pull out a shotty, cocking and popping on everybody. I'm telling you, shotty got me a 40 inside the caddy. I'm smoking the lighty, daddy, I'm blowing the down. Let me take one puff for the kill. Don't nobody knuckle up with this kill. Let me chill. Told me I can fool everybody that I'm with. Pack a tool, coke up, smoked out. If the bitches wanna stop, get them choked out. No doubt, I'm on one. Everybody get low when the loud come. Bang, 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 bye, bye. That's Shauna, not suitable for work, perhaps. slightly late for that, isn't it, really? That's Shauna featuring Jack Frost. Mm-hmm. Biddy bye bye. Alex, you brought this in. Tell us about Shauna. Tell us about Jack Frost. Tell us why you brought this in.
Yeah, I don't need to tell you about Jack Frost because he's kind of surplus to requirements there. It's all about Shauna.
Wow,
who is...
that's a bit harsh.
you don't need to pay attention to his verse. It's just her verse, which is the most incredible thing.
She's the one with the incredibly fast flow.
Yeah.
Yes, right.
She has been around since the early eras. She was a ludicrous prodigy back in the day. And I think she's an interesting figure to talk about because she never quite got over to being a superstar, even though she had a few big hits here and there, including RPM, which is probably one of the best songs of the OOs. Her flow is just insane on it. But when you're talking about this sort of new wave of female rappers post Nicki Minaj, there's lots of hype about Azealia Banks, about Creation, about Rima Major. And I think, attention deserves to be paid to some of the women who've been grafting who are super talented but undervalued, and Shauna is one of them. That's a new song. There's apparently a mixtape or an album is going to drop next year, but as is the way of hip hop, you're never quite sure.
Do we know who produced that? Because I liked the I liked her rapping, but I also like the background. I like the thing. I like that kind of weird meandering keyboard line that sort of runs through it.
It's very spaghetti western.
It all sounds a bit like the actual sound of the keyboard. And this is a very left field suggestion. It sounds not unlike the sound of the keyboard on the first two Soft Machine albums, which there I'm sure go. It's not who it's influenced by.
Well, you never know.
Wouldn't be
at all surprised.
But I just really like that kind of weird. It had a sort of slightly chaotic sense about it. Wasn't sound too strange.
Sadly, I don't know who produced it. It's just one of these songs that appeared on the internet with no real information. What I like about the background is it reminds me of sort of Kill Bill or something. So it sets her up as a sort of outlaw heroine who's going to sort of go gangbusters and shoot everyone.
Mm-hmm. It's got that kind of that guitar line in there, hasn't it? It's got that kind of guitar figure in there.
And her sense of rhythm, which relates to the beat, the way sort of leans on it and pops into her voice sort of repeats this and then goes fast and then sort of comes back again. That's one of my favourite sounds in rap. And she's always been like this throughout her whole career.
Great. Rob, I like this enormously. Did you like it as well?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I think it's the sort of thing where I need to listen to it another sort of 30 times to kind of feel like I'd got any kind of grasp on it. I think that's interesting the way that Alex was talking about how she sort of leans in and pulls out of it, because again, that's quite sort of cinematic in that way. Suddenly fast forward, then pull back and slow down and spin round and all that kind of... It's a very cinematic way of pitching your voice, but it's one of those things that it's kind of sonically it kind of grabs you, and you're amazed by the sonics and the sound of it and the feel of it without really kind of knowing without actually. It's very very dense, isn't it? It's very difficult to sort of. So I'd say that I like it sonically, but my relationship with it I'd have to go out on a few more dates with it before I thought whether I'm really into it.
Stuck your hand down in front of its pants. I like it. That Shauna featuring Jack Frost, Biddy Bye Bye, that is available on the internet as we speak, is it, if you know where
it is? If you just Google it,
it'll turn up.
It's not available for purchase anywhere.
How very decent of her.
That's very nice of her, isn't it?
I like her business model.
Moving on, we're looking at the last few programmes and the comments.
that have come in from the readers attached to them. Lots of your suggestions on the blog for the 2012 preview programme. Some worth checking out if you haven't already. The 2011 review programme brought up lots of memories of Amy Winehouse and discussion about whether Adele is really worse than LMFAO. Poor old Adele, for God's sake. I appreciate the woman's quite ubiquitous, but worse than LMFAO?
I heard that LMFAO song at the gymnastics the other day. I went to see the Olympic qualifications, and it was a weird thing. While they're actually doing the routines, they played this sort of panpipe
floaty music,
and then each of the sort of squads would sort of move around to the next thing, and in those bits they played sort of banging rave music, and in the middle of it all comes LMFAO. Every day I'm shuffling.
I listened
classic
to
classic tunes.
I had to review the LMFAO album, for which the purpose of research I also listened to their preceding album, which is I think the first album's called Party Rocking and the second album's called Sorry for Party Rocking. Fuck me, what a terrible, lifeless, just horrible, craven. It's just the worst
music. Good, right?
Oh yeah, I loved it.
Aren't they the nephews of some Motown legends?
Berry Gordy. Berry Gordy's nephews. Amazing.
Pissing on the family legacy.
I know. It's so poor old. You know. There's also an amazing bit on one of them where one of them makes reference to sipping on that Jesus juice.
Yeah.
Which I think is related to him via Jermaine Jackson or something like that. Which to make a reference to it seemed a very odd thing to be doing. But anyway, even so. Come on, people, let's be fair.
You know, but also, to interject, that's not her fault, is it?
No, it's not. And, you know, is she really worse?
I guess you could argue in favour of LMFAO by saying, I'm pretty sure LMFAO won't be annoying us in a couple of years' time, whereas Adele, sadly, will be grating on me for years and years to come.
But, I mean, she might do something different. She might do something, you know.
I doubt she'll ever do anything different.
Well, you know, I mean, there's more chance of that happening. Anyway, let's not talk about this anymore. Looking Left said, a far more interesting and entertaining podcast this week than I was expecting when I read the initial. Left. Just a crestfallen.
Bring you back down to earth.
That's just being a grumpy old man. I think you find this almost always the case. It's a more interesting podcast than it appears on paper. And our albums of 2011 programme blog. There were lots of suggestions on other albums that should have made the list, of course. No surprise at PJ Harvey topping it. Mm-hmm. A lot of anger. Kitty's suggestion that Florence of And the Machine fame should have even been allowed to sneak into the top
50. That's right, she shouldn't be allowed.
No.
Did Florence ever respond to, you know, when people said her video was racist?
What was it? Florence's racist video? Was she blacked up? Amazing.
No, she kind of gets chased by a blacked up guy.
Really?
Who's sticking pins into a voodoo doll of her.
No way.
And she gets sort of chased through these alleys by
that's so many different types of racism in one video, isn't it?
That's amazing.
And then she sort of falls off a cliff into the arms of some nice white choir boys who rescue her.
And that makes it the video. This isn't some weird dream you had. It's not like,
definitely not.
This is actually what her video is. Well, that's amazing. I mean, I'm very quite circumspect about crying racism as a, you know, also as a white middle class person, you know.
Yeah.
But that sounds a bit like something off Little Britain.
Yeah. Not that those guys were ever racist.
No, or indeed
funny.
No.
She could argue that. Okay. If I was to argue Florence's point, I've never seen a video, so it's going to be tricky.
This is going to be a great.
But she could say, well, the person who's blacked up is no. It's not going to work, is it?
And she could say, you know, it's art, it's symbolism, whatever. But when you're playing with art and symbolism, you kind of know what these things represent.
Yeah.
And she's a smart girl. I think she should probably know what those things represent.
I'm sure she's not. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure it wasn't her intention to go,
you know what, let's go for the racist lines.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm just amazed.
Let's get that whole Stormfront audience in here. You know.
I'm just amazed at all the people that video must have gone through. Because she's a major pop star. Mm. Yeah. All those people who must have okayed it. And not one of them went, well,
you're,
hang
again,
on,
you're back to
racist.
Little Britain. You're back to that thing where you see something comes on the telly, you see a video like that, and you go, how come someone didn't go, it's not funny?
Well, I've been reading two books about Michael Jackson, which is an extreme example.
Yeah.
But there's this sort of sense that Michael Jackson's obviously decline in the quality of his work. You know, slow decline, but it sets in after Bad. Mm. And, you know, things go and Invincible. Mm. The general, it's taken as read in both these books. The reason his final album, Invincible, didn't sell was because there was some huge industry-wide conspiracy against Michael Jackson. The reason Invincible didn't sell is no fucking good.
Yeah.
It just strikes me that in Michael Jackson's career, he got so rich and famous that nobody could... It got to the stage where Quincy Jones wasn't there anymore and nobody could say to him, you know, it's enough already with the children's choirs. Do what you do well. Do tour exciting. Dance music, do, you know, kind of big ballads, but then there's schlock, you know. And maybe there's an element of that with an artist like Florence. She sold a lot of fucking records at a time when other people aren't selling a lot of records. Are you going to start, you know,
But I bet you she would, and someone probably will now, but I bet you she would go, well, actually, you guys have totally misread it. But the other thing is, like with Michael Jackson, the other thing is, you know, he'd also probably reached that point where, you know, he'd drained the well. There was no other good songs to write. You know, everybody's only got that many good songs in them.
But he still made it. The thing with Michael Jackson is that I don't say he's still capable of making amazing records. Mm. Scream is an amazing record. Black or White is an amazing record. You know, he makes brilliant songs.
Yeah.
But this is just my theory.
Yeah, yeah.
He appeared to be a man totally devoid of any sense of taste.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Except in the world of music and choreography. There's an amazing bit where, in the Jermaine Jackson's biography, it's completely off the point, but this is kind of interesting, where he describes Michael Jackson single-handedly remodels the family home.
Yeah.
And it's just, what he does is fucking from hell. And at one point, again, Jermaine Jackson goes, you know, who just thinks everything is wonderful that Michael does. Goes out, you know, I walk into this room and I was amazed at his creativity. One wall was entirely consumed with a mural of Michael Jackson sitting in a tree reading a book called The Meaning of Life.
Wow.
So, you know, he just got a ghastly, you know, terrible thing. And it was almost like that's what seeped into his music.
Yeah.
Towards the end. So you've got these awful songs like The Lost Children.
Invincible was terrible. And it's kind of terrible because it was so ordinary. Rather than like in the sort of dangerous and history days with Stranger in Moscow, it's like over the top, paranoid.
Yeah.
Like overblown.
Yeah.
Ballads.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's sort of like channeling his craziness through the music.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's it. I think that's the other problem is that he realised, even in that kind of weird sequestered world that he lived in, he sort of realised, oh, my image is completely out of control. Everybody thinks I'm basically a kiddie fiddling head case.
Yeah.
I've got to prove I'm normal.
Yeah.
So if you listen to Invincible, how the fuck we got this enormous discussion about Michael Jackson's, you know, album from 2002. If you listen to Invincible, there's things on there that are clearly meant to sound a bit like off the wall. But most of it is actually quite, as you say, boring. What a lot of distance we can traverse on this podcast. From Florence, from whether Florence's album was, is she a racist, Michael Jackson, we've covered the lot. Your comments, please, for Music Weekly in 2012 are now open. We're after your contributions. Find the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly or tweet your thoughts at musicweeklypod. That's it for this week's programme. We will be back next Friday. My thanks to Rob.
Hello, thank you, goodbye.
My thanks to Alex.
Goodbye.
Excellent. And thank you, of course, most of all for listening. Listen to me, Mr. Sincerity. Thank you most of all for listening. I'm Alexis Petridis, and the programme was produced, as ever, by Scott Cawley. Bye-bye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.